Architects now work in a climate of anxiety, owing to the discovery of their decline as active ideologues, the realization of the vast potential of technology in the rationalization of the city and outlying areas, together with the daily awareness of its waste, and the obsolescence of specific planning methods even before they have had a chance to be tested. All this points to a concrete development on the horizon, feared as the worst of all evils, the proletarianization of the architect, and his insertion, with no more neo-humanistic delays, within the planning programs of production. Manfredo Tafuri, Towards a Critique of Architectural Ideology, 1969. You are listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture. This is issue number 8, talking about my generation. I'm Tim Cox, the guest editor and narrator for the issue. This episode will be my editorial conclusion. I've spent the majority of this issue of Attention constructing a generation by building narratives. Narratives of shared ideological commitments, aesthetic affinities, and intellectual genealogies. Undergirding these narratives are the structural base of material conditions within the academies and the construction industry in the United States. As several interviewees pointed out, this presentation of work and ideas as generational is bound to be reductive. Focusing on what is shared between individuals usually takes place at the expense of their many differences. This presentation is also inherently exclusionary and inconclusive, choosing only 33 voices out of the thousands of architecture academics in America working today. My ambition was not to ignore the particularities of the participants, or to ignore the experiences of those not interviewed, but instead to use the discursive frame of a generation as an abstraction, a useful tool to think about how changes over the past decades, institutional, economic, political, and technological, have impacted academic architectural culture. From the data provided by the interviews, I could build narratives, make claims, and air critiques of contemporary architectural discourse. I'm a generation younger than the cohort we've heard from across this issue. While this generation's academic careers were defined by the discourse of post-criticality and the 2008 financial crash, I began architecture school in 2017, during Trump's first term, and a few years before COVID and the murder of George Floyd. One day I was falling in love with the white-on-white work of Anna Niemark, the stud walls of Aaron Bezler, and the shapely drawings of Jimenez Lai. The next, I was watching a live stream of the burning Third Precinct in Minneapolis. I succeeded and failed in studying both. I found tremendous value and pleasure in architecture as a cultural practice of meaning-making, as it was taught to me in school. But in our cultural context, I was simultaneously aware of architecture's role as an arm of capital, which is instrumental in mass incarceration, widening inequality, and the warming climate. I argue that this generation, like previous groups of architectural academics, and especially those in the US, are primarily invested in architecture as a cultural practice which produces meaning through distinctly disciplinary methods, ranging from form and material to representation and semiotics. However, the discipline, which I'm using here as shorthand for architectural knowledge that is distinct from technical training, is strained by the blunt realities of architectural production in our current historical moment, like the increasing precarity of academia, the communication revolution of social media, and the crises of capitalism and the climate. This generation's ambitions to produce significant buildings and to craft work that is instrumental for progressive politics are strained by their structural conditions. I will spend this conclusion attempting to unpick the successes, failures, and contradictions of this generation's attempts to metabolize cultural forces and produce contemporary architecture. This generation reported that the construction industry in the United States was hostile to young architects, and that they struggled to build without pre-existing connections to wealth. Risk-averse clients, huge multinational firms, and a cultural disinterest in architecture all contributed to their difficulty in building. But at a more fundamental level, their observations trace the basic structure of architecture as a profession, that of a client and a service provider, of capital and labor. Clients vary, each with their own idiosyncratic appetites for aesthetic or programmatic experimentation. But within the contractual relationship of practice, the power of the architect is profoundly limited. Architects do act as legal enforcers, translating client desires into code-compliant construction. But we do not author the programmatic requirements that clients commission us to make space for, and we are not participants in the way spaces are actually operated, in how many people are made to share a bedroom or a cell. We do not determine budgets or choose how funds will be allocated. Architects propose solutions to clients and can proceed only with their approval. In this sense, the proposal is the defining discursive genre of architecture, and it is the structural limit of our power. Of course, the proposals of architects are often accepted. Clients, and capital more broadly, acknowledge aesthetic and spatial expertise for its ability to generate value and cultural cachet. While the base of economic and labor relations doesn't guarantee architects' power in the production of the built environment, some power does exist interpersonally and culturally. And these socio-cultural channels are where architects have historically attempted to execute their ideas and produce social reform. But these channels seem to be narrowing, with a shared sense across the interviews that the ability to produce culturally compelling architecture is becoming harder and harder. To restate this generation's perception of the construction industry in more Marxist terms, the cultural superstructure seems to be catching up with the base of labor relations. Tafuri highlighted a similar shift in his seminal Towards a Critique of Architectural Ideology, where he described the proletarianization of architects. For Tafuri, architects were once empowered as ideologues of modernity and were useful to the expansion of capitalist power due to their wholehearted embrace of industrialized production, from the scale of industrial design to the planning of cities. At the time of writing, in 1969, Tafuri saw architects as subsumed by capitalist processes of production. Instead of viewing themselves as an avant-garde which aspired to marshal the working class towards a better future, architects just became working class themselves, yet another producer within the expanding factory of society. K. Michael Hayes glosses Tafuri's essay as a reading of architectural history where, quote, the avant-garde's visions of utopia are inevitably distorted into a sublimation of capital itself, a transfiguration of the latter's relentless rationality into the rationality of autonomous form. Close quote. Architectural autonomy is a discourse that responded to modern architects' proletarianization by retreating into the academy. The hermetic, well-funded, and class-stratified world of the American university system became a new site where architecture could produce ideological authority. The autonomous tradition of academic architectural practice that this issue of attention has in part been tracing is defined by a distinction between academia and practice, where practice is viewed as compromised by the market and ethically ambiguous, in contrast to the isolated freedom of the university. The belief that one is not making compromises with capital while teaching or studying architecture, or that these compromises are easier to live with, is a critical component of academic architecture's intellectual project. The speculative work that architects and students produce in academia is freed from the client-service provider labor relation that structures practice, so there's no one to reject architects' proposals, leaving them unconstrained by demand, funding, or feasibility. Undesirable typologies can simply be ignored in favor of more politically desirable organizations of program. The popular aesthetics of suburbia, HGTV, and Instagram can be jettisoned in favor of more refined, experimental, or iconoclastic tastes. In such autonomous circumstances, architecture can be a more straightforwardly artistic practice, with authorship less compromised by input from contractors, trades, clients, or the law. An architectural approach that has discursive value can be iteratively refined within academia before it's subjected to the many limitations of practice. Members of this generation express similar sentiments across the interviews, explaining their desire to not just be practicing architects, but to test their academic ideas in built form, and to make work that speaks to culture. Those architects who have historically succeeded within this model worked for years in academia to produce an architectural project that was celebrated and awarded internally before actualizing their proposals through built work. The disciplinary autonomy of academia is not legitimately isolationist. It's a strategy for producing academic expertise that can be cashed out as cultural authority within practice. However, despite this generation's disciplinary educations and their own architectural expertise as aesthetes and artists, they are defined by a full-throated rejection of the Eisenmanian discourse of autonomy and the strategy of internal disciplinary refinement which it signals. The reasons they gave for this rejection were numerous, from finding the loud, opinionated affects of disciplinary experts uncomfortable, to their rejection of sole authorship, their desire to expand architectural audiences beyond the academies, and their political resistance to avoiding the economic realities of architectural practice. They saw attempts to focus on disciplinary concerns alone as increasingly irrelevant, which is to say that despite their successful development of individual architectural projects, through their own virtuosic knowledge of the discipline, they have, with a few exceptions, failed to generate the culturally legible architectural authority which would allow them to translate their proposals into built form. This generation's rejection of internal disciplinary concerns and their symbolic father figure in Peter Eisenman can be read as a response to the devaluation of architectural expertise within culture more broadly. The building up of disciplinary capital within academia, in the style of Eisenman, Libeskind, Shumi, Kuhlhaas, or Hadid, is no longer a feasible strategy for launching a building practice. This generation's rejection of disciplinary autonomy is not just Oedipal or ideological, but is an admission that the discourse of autonomy as a technique for producing architectural authority is not working in the way it did decades ago. We can even hear a version of this from Eisenman himself. In a memorable 2010 lecture at the AA, frustrated by the large-scale, profit-driven planning that was overriding the architectural expertise of his firm, Eisenman asked, quote, "At what point do you retire? This is not something I share with my clients because it pays the bills, but I'm not convinced that we are any longer in control." Close quote. There was a deep vein of melancholy across the interviews, a sense that the type of architecture this generation wanted to pursue just wasn't possible. While there have been many societal shifts in the past decades, perhaps most relevant are the ways that the carefully constructed isolation of architectural academia has been worn down by the neoliberalization of higher ed. As universities become more like businesses, academic design labor has become more entrepreneurial, competitive, precarious, demanding, and specialized. As we heard throughout this issue, the short-term contracts of fellowships and adjunct positions, the high volume of output expected from tenure-track faculty, and the burden of student loan debt are all key parts of this generation's context. They described working through the mediums of installations, gallery exhibitions, group shows, and short-form writing in response to a demand for marketable output amidst increasing precarity. Returning to Tafuri's proclamation of the proletarianization of architects, we could say that this generation is reckoning with the proletarianization of academics. Academia's demands seem to increase as architects' cultural relevance decreases. The continuous stream of images, discourses, and architectural proposals is forced into dialogue with the discipline's lack of authority. We can even go so far as to understand this group's output as an aestheticization of their lack of cultural authority over building, an embrace of their marginalization within architectural practice. Some members of this group hone in on standard construction practices, as in Michelle Chang's 2020 Scoring Building installation, which reads a construction schedule as a musical score, or Anna Niemark and Andrew Atwood's work with screws and paint specifications, or Paul Preisner's contribution to the 2021 U.S. Pavilion American Framing. The reclamation of the not interesting or the boring is a way of shifting architectural attention towards elements that are guaranteed to be present in a project. No one will value engineer out stick framing or paint. Other work tweaks standard, unchallenging forms, like gable roof houses, into new configurations, as an Outpost Office's longhouse, New Affiliates' Turnbridge Winter Cabin, and Moss's house 2, 7, 10, 16, 20, and 21. These multiplications, twists, and cuts operate on familiar geometry to make each project's form far more legible to a layperson than Eisenman's translations for house 6 might be. Discursively, this generation argued that aesthetic approaches of informality and loose composition would expand architectural audiences through their legibility and open-endedness, which suggest accessible participation, imagining architecture could be as simple as playing with blocks. While typically framed as a politically progressive gesture, this metaphorical inviting of the public into the design studio can also be read as a way to generate buy-in from a culture which will no longer accept the compositional and aesthetic authority of architects. An approach which permits multiple aesthetics and doesn't require formal precision acknowledges client interference in the architectural project from the start. This generation's rejection of perfection is another indication of their efforts to engage with their lack of power as aesthetic producers. In their speculative work, they produce real beauty through the embrace of imperfection, as in David Eskenazi's works in paper, Kelly Baer and Christy Ballier's Unstable Domestic Forms, Anna Niemark and Andrew Atwood's MoMA PS1 Dolmen, or Kyle Reynolds' Bad Lines. But, ironically, the aesthetics of failure rely on careful calibration and are largely absent from this generation's built work, which only has the budget for straight lines and simple tectonic stability. In their compelling efforts to aesthetically address their own inability to build, we can see this generation's lingering engagement with architectural disciplinarity. Despite their many critiques of the discipline and its waning ability to meaningfully confer authority, they remain committed to disciplinary ideologies about the cultural role of architects and were positioned primarily as aesthetic producers. In their pursuit of discursively compelling architecture, they align themselves against the professionalized, technocratic architecture of firms like AECOM or Gensler. They also differentiated themselves from architectural work which focuses on the quantifiable questions of architecture. As Michael Meredith argued in his Indifference Again article, this generation is not interested in, quote, engaged problem solving and tackling, for example, sustainability in building. This generation does address questions like sustainability through their work, but they operate at the disciplinary levels of aesthetics, discourse, and consciousness raising more frequently than they represent legitimate, scalable solutions. Team's Detroit Reassembly Plant project is a good example. One of the most exciting and frequently mentioned projects by this generation, the scheme intervenes on architecture's relationship to material flows, proposing a factory for combining existing, unused matter in the built environment with consumer waste to cast new messy mixtures of material into useful forms. In the swirls of plastic and construction debris, the project makes a compelling disciplinary argument for reimagining the image of post-industrial Detroit as full of raw material for reuse, a narrative which rethinks more traditional discourses of sustainability and architecture. However, Team does not attempt to solve the systematic issues which they gesture towards. They don't address the R values of these new synthetic materials, highlight their role in an efficient building envelope, or quantify the proposal by measuring its carbon impact, for example. These are not critiques per se, but are just an acknowledgement of the bounded ways in which this generation's work interfaces with broader social questions. Like artists, this generation of architects produce work that is about big issues, not work that proposes solutions. In this way, the specter of Eisenmanian autonomy, of a separation between the realities of the world and the discursive space of the discipline of architecture, still haunts their ideological frame. This generation still operates at a remove from the profession, offering discursive, critical responses to the built environment through aesthetics. This argument can be extended to the realms of politics and ideology, where this generation similarly articulates its positions through the disciplinary means of aesthetics, representation, and form. Part of the editorial value I found in carefully reading and assembling the interviews that constituted this issue of attention was the ability to identify shared language. The vocabulary of pluralism was by far the most widespread idiom. Ideologically, this generation gathered around pluralism at every opportunity. But why? Unlike writing, the interview format denies respondents the iterative, deliberative process through which coherent arguments are built. It's unsurprising, then, that there was no offered definition of pluralism across the interviews. So I'll instead turn to Andrew Holder's introductory essay from 2021's Inscriptions. Holder explains, quoting Carla Umatle and pulling from philosophical and political theorizations of the concept that, quote, pluralism entails reckoning with the fact that the immense, contradictory, and varying flow of human life renders it irreducible and unaccountable from the perspective of one single outlook. The brutality of this realization makes for two halves of the pluralist project. First, there is the task of merely admitting and naming the irreconcilable differences evident in an empirical survey of the world. Second, there is the implicit expectation that pluralists offer some common venue where these differences could make contact without lapsing into hostility, schism, or all-out collapse. Close quote. Holder goes on to argue for a pluralistic approach to architecture and criticism that is open to difference. He situates this argument within a context where architecture as a field is already understood as a series of, quote, incommensurable fragments. Holder's description of architecture's splintering was supported by the interviewees across this issue of attention. Aesthetics could only be described via list. Theory, ideology, and politics were all polyphonous and focused on including new voices, and the disciplines seemed to be simultaneously expanding and specializing. Of interest in this conclusion are the reasons why this fragmentation continues to be reproduced within academia, why pluralism has become the language of choice to describe contemporary architectural culture, and the locating of pluralism's discursive limits. Throughout the issue, we heard many explanations for the phenomenon of pluralism, like the impact of 80s postmodern thought or the proliferation of discourse on the internet and social media since the 90s. We can also tie the vocabulary of pluralism to the liberal focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion, which followed the George Floyd uprisings of 2020, as well as this generation's rejection of previous incarnations of the discipline that relied on antagonistic, binary positioning to define the field. Despite pluralism's associations with the noble and faltering political projects of democracy and diversity, pluralism's hegemony as an architectural ideology is more accurately a response to the tightening pressures on intellectual labor in academia, and is ultimately compatible with the privatizing, commodifying, and productivity-boosting goals of the neoliberalizing university. First, pluralism's celebration of differences manifests within architectural culture as a horizontalist equality between wildly distinct projects. From the disciplinary historical to the professionally crafted, the imperative of inclusion grants projects equal standing and requires they be judged in isolation and not evaluated in relation to broader ideological frames which make normative claims about the built environment. A proposal for a sustainable housing development can be presented next to an ironic project about furry rocks. In this way, pluralistic tolerance opens up territory for disciplinary settlement, allowing academic workers to craft entrepreneurial architectural projects with minimal constraint. We might trace this line of thinking back to this generation's metabolization of the post-critical moment in the early 2000s. Part of how this cohort understood that formative theoretical moment was that it was productive. It yielded a higher volume of work because it freed designers from the need to participate in critical design in the Eisenmanian tradition, expanding the range of permissible projects. A downside of this opening up of possibility is that becoming unmoored from a broader ideological project also makes it more difficult to justify individual aesthetic tendencies and design decisions as anything other than individual. What is gained in freedom is lost in social meaning. And it begs the question, if everything can be accepted, on what terms can architecture be rejected? Second, pluralism alleviates pressure for any one practitioner to synthesize a holistic response to the contemporary built environment. Instead, individuals pursue specialized, differentiated projects as is demanded by the academic job market. This generation discussed the imperative to specialize as a structuring force behind their output, with their chosen zones of expertise keeping them away from important questions that land in the territories of other practitioners. An academic working on novel modes of digital fabrication is not likely to have overlap with an academic who produces knowledge about how race and gender operate in and through the built environment. At its best, specialization results in a wealth of distinct knowledge, but at its worst, specialization becomes tokenization, leaving important questions to only a handful of academics. Without shared priorities or values, pluralism flattens architectural culture into individual, commodified perspectives. Third, we heard pluralism discussed in the issue as a result of the disappearance of the figure of design theorist or critic from the architectural scene. This left academic architects to perform both the task of production and interpretation. In a prior historical moment, theoretical authorities like K. Michael Hayes, Mark Wigley, Beatrice Colomina, Catherine Ingraham, Sylvia Lavin, etc., all shaped discourse around architecture. This generation didn't identify important writers in their own generation, whose work was in conversation with contemporary architectural production. Perspectives on why this occurred varied, from the current vogue for architectural historians as a result of expanded PhD programs, to a generational desire to be able to speak for oneself. Regardless, the collapse of multiple roles and responsibilities into a single figure is consistent with the neoliberalization of academia, where designers have the responsibility of both producing and discursively marketing their work. And fourth, pluralism was understood as a response to the internet and social media, which has revolutionized the dispersion of architecture and recontextualized it as a result. Feeds of images on Instagram, Tumblr, or Pinterest democratize architectural visual culture by replacing traditional gatekeepers with individual creators, whose output is fed through the black box of proprietary algorithms. Instead of seeking out architecture that has been curated and thoughtfully selected, architecture is delivered to us in a seemingly infinite grid. Styles, historical contexts, and authors are all interchangeable. I might open Instagram to a new parametric stadium, artfully composed metal studs in a gallery, or a lesser-known house by a well-known architect. All posts which are tuned to my patterns of use and attention, but which have no meaningful through line aesthetically, ideologically, or politically. Platforms like Instagram do not benefit from carefully constructing an architectural discourse or project. They aim to maximize user engagement. A pluralistic architectural culture is well suited to the corporate goal of diverse but interchangeable flows of images. To summarize, pluralism supports the entrepreneurial specialization of individuals in order to increase productivity within the neoliberal academy. When understood as an ideological endpoint, pluralism is entirely compatible with the needs of market-driven individuation, which function to further proletarianize academic labor. This is not to say that I would want to live in a non-pluralistic society, that I long for some imagined past where architects spoke with a singular voice, or that it is viable to reject wholesale the metrics of evaluation that make one employable. But pluralism is not a robust or particularly progressive architectural ideology. It's just a necessary prerequisite for the development of an ideological project. It also has dubious political implications when it's extended beyond architectural methods and becomes a way to understand people and the world. While it's undeniable that human life is varied and contradictory, terms like difference or diversity come to operate within pluralist discourse in ways which do not question how those differentiations in individuals or voices are produced through violence. Vectors of difference like class, race, or gender are socially generated and enforced, often through the built environment. The danger of pluralism as an ideological endpoint is the acceptance and naturalization of these differences. While we can see the adoption of pluralistic language in this generation, in part as a response to the George Floyd uprisings of 2020, the pluralist position is unable to actually address questions of anti-blackness, power, or oppression because they cannot advocate for one voice over another, or for one position over another. Pluralism is satisfied with their hierarchically structured coexistence. I'm left with a series of difficult questions. What would it look like to resist pluralism's commodified horizontalism within architectural academia? How can individuated, specialized practices molded by the requirements of the neoliberal university actually engage with the world rather than merely talking about it? How much can we ask of architects and academics when our discipline does not have the power to actually shape the built environment, when we are merely decorating capital's predetermined forms? Adolfo Natalini of Superstudio famously said, quote, "If design is merely an inducement to consume, then we must reject design. If architecture is merely the codifying of bourgeois models of ownership and society, then we must reject architecture. If architecture and town planning is merely the formalization of present unjust social divisions, then we must reject town planning and its cities until all design activities are aimed towards meeting primary needs. Until then, design must disappear. We can live without architecture." Close quote. But we are already living without architecture. What would it take to change that? You've been listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture. Issue 8, talking about my generation. The writing, editing, and production for this episode was by Tim Cox. Thanks to the Graham Foundation for advanced studies in the fine arts for their generous support. Thank you to my dear friends, Virginia, John, and Carl for their help in reading this conclusion.